Before I introduce our guest today, I want to ask everybody, please go to Facebook page and search Bark for the Blue and buy a calendar. The Tucson Police Department are selling these amazing calendars. They're 18-month calendars, and the proceeds are going to go to buy equipment to protect the canines, and they desperately need equipment. So you know what happened to Blitz about a month ago, being stabbed. We need equipment on our dogs. So do your Christmas shopping early. Get everybody a calendar with pictures of these amazing dogs. And save the date, the 8th of September. Mark it on your calendar, and there'll be more information coming in a week or two, and it'll be on my website, lawmatters1030.org. Our guest today is John, retired agent from the FBI. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about you, your history, what's going on.
Well, I was an FBI agent for about 21 years here in Phoenix, one of the assistant special agent in charge. Prior to that, I had been a police officer in San Diego, and because I wanted to be an FBI agent, I went to law school nights, got my law degree in San Diego, and eventually practiced law for a while before joining the FBI.
What did you practice law? What field?
I was in civil litigation. I was doing much of that while I was still on the police department, so I was very careful to stay out of the criminal world. I didn't want to arrest people and then defend them at the same time. I thought that might be frowned upon.
Conflict of interest? Okay. You've written several books since you've been retired, or was this while you were still working?
Well, I did a couple when I was still working, but I've done another since I've been retired. I've got another one sitting with the publisher now. But essentially, after having a long FBI career, I started working as a consultant after my job with the FBI ended to be able to continue to keep businesses and people safe. And I've tried to write books along those lines of providing practical information. And let me tell you, first of all, the books are there so that people can get the information. It's not about making me rich. Anybody who's done any publishing knows publishers get all the money. I've sold thousands of books and made hundreds of dollars. But that information is out there, and it's a great resource and guide to help keep people safe.
I'm looking at the cover of this one book, and WTF.
That's right, WTF, Why Teens Fail and What to Fix.
There you go. Okay, how did this book come about?
Well, with a group of officers and educators in the Phoenix area, we got together and we decided we all have different expertise when it comes to helping keep children safe. So I had spent years going after online predators, much like you would see on Dateline. But also in the cyber world, it's much more than just predators that can affect children. For example, a lot of people don't realize they worry about their credit report, and we see these ads for credit monitoring. But does anyone ever really think about their kids? Most people that are victims of identity theft are actually under the age of 18. And the reason for that is if I steal your identity, you're going to know in a couple of days, you're going to get an alert, you're going to be able to jump on it. But your kids are not using credit cards. They're not making mortgage payments. If I steal your six-year-old's identity, chances are they're not going to know about it until they're 18 and try to go to college. I had one case in Phoenix working for the FBI, a young lady who was going to ASU. When she showed up, it turns out she had $1 million in debt, not to mention a criminal history because somebody had been using her identity. I had cautioned parents, make sure that you're monitoring not just your identity, but monitor your children's identity as well.
Yeah, no kidding. I didn't think of that.
Well, most people don't, and that's my job, is to make sure that the public knows the things that law enforcement knows that is not otherwise common knowledge.
So what are the challenges, other than having your ID stolen, what are the challenges that teenagers face today? Compared to even when my son was little, it's so different.
You know, the world's changing constantly with the technology we have. When my kids were little, we worried about what they were doing on the computer. Now, we're not even concerned about the computer because they're walking around with their smartphones, and that's a computer in and of itself. Bullying, when we were children, you might be a victim of being bullied during school hours. Now, it's 24/7, and it never stops. Those are issues that have to be addressed, And parents need to know that what can be done. The reality is with bullying, there's a certain number of bullies out there and there's a certain number of victims. Statistically, about 85% of the rest of the student population is just bystanders watching what goes on. So we teach people that if just one person gets involved and pushes back verbally, says, don't do that, the bully usually backs down and then looks for another victim elsewhere. But the important thing is to stop the person who's the victim from being bullied. Those issues, teenage suicide, dating, date rape, all these issues that affects today's generation are issues that are covered in the book by myself and my colleagues who co-wrote the book with me, giving parents information that they can use to try to keep their kids safe.
So tell me where people can find these books. Let's give the audience your contacts.
Sure. Well, first of all, please, my Twitter is FBI John, as well as my website is www.fbijohn.com. You can go to my website for any one of these books, but they're also available on Amazon. They're also available in many bookstores, but today everybody's buying online. So yeah. Just go to Amazon, look for any one of the books we're going to talk about this morning, and you'll be able to place an order and get the book delivered right to your home.
And as long as you're shopping on Amazon, go to Amazon Smiles and pick a charity to support. I have the FBI Fallen Officers support thing on mine, and it tells me annually how much I've donated because of all my shopping on Amazon.
Great suggestion.
Yeah, it's a good organization to support, and I think there's a lot of local organizations on there as well. So
absolutely.
Okay, what should parents, if parents read your book, WTF, what are they going to get out of it?
Well, first, they're going to get some insight to issues that they hadn't really thought about. The problem with parenting today is we don't know the questions to ask much at a time because we think of in terms of, well, don't talk to strangers, because that's what we were taught. Well, the reality is, you know, you go on the internet, everybody's a stranger. You go to these hookup sites, which is what kids do to meet other people and date. Everybody is a stranger. So are we teaching our children what a stranger is? Because the definition of stranger has changed. Kids today, young teens, young adults, when they go online and they see someone's profile and they become a friend with them online, they think they're a friend. They're not a stranger.
The implication.
Absolutely. But the reality is anybody you haven't met in person is a stranger. More importantly, people lie. Predators lie. Other people lie. Just like people put nicer pictures of themselves than they may really appear, they lie about what their accomplishments are. They lie about what the negative things in their life. So they're not going to necessarily have, I've been arrested for sexual assault, on that website. Parents need to be aware of some of these dangers are out there and have honest conversations with their kids. But unfortunately, parents don't know, so they're not thinking in terms to even have these conversations. That's what you find in WTF.
Yeah, I've said it a zillion times. You don't know what you don't know until you've gone to some of these classes. And we've had TPD, Jennifer Crawford, on a lot talking about sex trafficking. And just because your kids live at home doesn't mean this isn't happening to them, because it happens.
So let me tell you something about the sex trafficking. And having worked for years and years online, I actually had undercover agents pretending to be children where we would lure predators. We never entrap or entice because, frankly, it is so easy. The thing that parents may not realize when they see on the news, we've gotten a predator off the street, or this predator was working as a teacher in a school, they feel safer. But when we go into these chat rooms, there might be 100 screen names, each and every one of which clearly is a predator, which you can tell just based on the name, such as child lover and things like that. We can go after one or two of these people. The other 98, 99 are walking scot-free. It is shooting fish in a barrel for us. So it's very easy to make these cases because there's so many of them. But if I had all 850,000 uniformed police officers in this country doing nothing going after predators online, we would not be able to arrest all the predators that are out there. Statistically, we have 650,000 registered sex offenders in the United States.
Wow.
Those are the ones who have taken the time to register, who have not refused to register and are in the wind somewhere. And it certainly doesn't include anybody that we haven't discovered and arrested yet. The internet can be a really dangerous place if you don't know where you're going. We haven't even touched on the dark web or the deep web where all this nefarious activity takes place. Bottom line is, you got to have these conversations with your kids starting at a young age. Keep them safe. And if I can add, it's not just their smartphones. These kids sitting around gaming on consoles, nobody is gaming by themselves or the kids sitting next to them. They're gaming with strangers on the internet, and I have yet to arrest a predator that did not have one of these devices in their home because they're online gaming with other kids, asking questions along the way. Where do you live? Where do you go to school? When do your parents get home? You got to know what to do to keep people and keep your family safe.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people think about the gaming part of it because that's a good way to get into a kid's head because so many of them are out there just, that's what they do. They're not out playing basketball or football or, you know, tag, kick the can like we did. But, you know, they're online.
It is an indoor world. And these predators are smart. They will go online. They will learn common music for what the kids' interests are. They'll know the terms and vernacular the kids are using so they can appear to be one of the kids when in reality, everyone I've ever arrested has always been much older.
What is that, Urban Dictionary? Have you used that?
Sure. In the Urban Dictionary, where you can find out what things mean.
Yes.
For FBI, for training, we used to find agents who had teenage kids and bring the kids in to help train our agents on what the music is of the day, what kids say,
what it means,
what they don't say. And as the kids would get older, we'd find another agent with other kids that are age appropriate. and there was never a shortage of that. And that's how we would keep our agents savvy of what's going on out on the street.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a few. Okay, we're here with John, who used to be an FBI agent. He's retired. He's now an author. And let's talk a little bit. I had InfraGuard on last week. We were talking about how the community can get involved and be educated. And I think a lot of people just wander around thinking it's somebody else's job. It's everybody's job. And I know you've written a book, Information Governance and Security. Tell me about that.
You're absolutely right that it's everybody's job. The reason being is everybody is a potential victim. So if you don't want to think about it helping your community, think about it for helping yourself. There is so much cybercrime taking place out there. And I wrote the book on information governance basically to try to help small businesses understand what the threats are. The pushback I see in the cyber world is most small businesses say, well, who's going to target me? I'm not worth a lot of money compared to, say, Target or Home Depot, which have been breached. Who's going to come after me? The reality is the small to medium-sized business is exactly the target that criminals online are looking for. The reason being is most of these big box stores have plenty of money to spend on cybersecurity, and they do, whereas the smaller businesses are more interested in making ends meet, and they're not going to worry about a problem that they think can't affect them. It's not to say that these small and medium-sized businesses have to spend huge amounts of money, but they need to just take some very simple basic precautions, making it a little more difficult because cyber criminals are going to go for the low-hanging fruit. And it's like the adage of, you know, if you and I are in the woods and a bear comes, I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you. Well, it's the same thing in the cyber world. If you are a little bit of a harder target, they're going to go on and hit the next target that is easier to break into. So people need to be aware how to keep themselves and their businesses safe.
If anybody has any questions, the online number is 790-2040. And what are, other than not running faster than you, what are some of the other threats facing a small business?
So, for example, right now, ransomware is very big. And essentially what ransomware is, you may get a pop-up saying your system's infected, click on this link. Well, the reality is that link is downloading malware onto your computer. It's a trap to lull you into thinking that somebody's helping you when really what they're hurting you. And they put malware on your computer, which is just another software program, but it's a program controlled remotely by the person who conned you into downloading it. They can lock up your computer, keep you from getting access to any of your files, which can be a significant problem in the business world, but it could also be deadly. We've had situations where doctor's offices and hospitals had malware and were charged huge amounts of money just so that they would get access to their files again. So two things businesses can be aware of. Number one, never click on a link from anyone you don't recognize. And even if you do recognize the person, you got to make sure the link is legit. Number two, have your files backed up. That way, if your computer is infected and somebody wants to charge you $100,000, you can just wipe your computer clean and download your files that you saved elsewhere, and you're back in business. But now you're a little smarter about what happened, and it won't happen again.
So if a small business is attacked by one of these people, what is to keep them from being attacked again? What kind of security devices should they put on their computer?
It's a great question. So the reality is there's so many cyber criminals out there. Being attacked multiple times is not unusual. I will tell you, if you go to the store today and buy a brand new computer, bring it home and open up the box and go to plug that computer in, you probably have about 5 minutes before your computer's attacked.
Oh.
That is how quickly it happens. So what you want to do is you want to make sure you have the antivirus software on your computer. A lot of people, when they're buying the computers, are like, eh, I'm not going to pay all these extra charges. They want $100 for an annual subscription. It's the most important thing you can have, having that antivirus software scanning for malware. The other thing is when you get these notifications from Microsoft and others that you need to update and your software and your security, every time you get one of those legitimate notifications, it means they found a vulnerability that allows cyber criminals to get access to your computer and your files. They fixed it, and by downloading the update patch, you are now protected as well. But the best thing to do, some basic computer security, which is never click on anything you don't know for certain. Sony is a great example. We had that hack a couple years back involving the movie The Interview.
Yes.
And North Korea came in and was able to hack into Sony because out of their thousands and thousands of employees, one employee clicked on a link, downloading malware, which gave North Korea access. It wound up costing Sony billions of dollars, not to mention reputation. You may remember at the time, North Korea lost their internet access for a few days afterwards, which clearly was a sign from the U.S. that, hey, we can do things too if you mess with our businesses.
We're going to mess with you too.
Yes, but the problem is, you know, Sony loses billions of dollars, seven people in North Korea couldn't get on Facebook. It's really not a fair trade-off, so it's more important that we protect ourselves. And I will add finally, this is exactly what some of these state-sponsored organizations want to do. You look at what's going on in Iran today, and certainly North Korea is problematic. It's not just about attacking the U.S. government. It's about attacking individual businesses, no matter how big and small, because that's how you hurt the U.S. economy. And that's what these countries want to do. So you're not just fighting off cyber criminals. You're being patriotic by fighting off terrorist states that want to hurt the United States by hurting you.
And it is a form of terrorism.
Absolutely. It's going on. It has, since the internet was developed, it's been happening, and it's going to continue. And it's an inexpensive way to fight a war against another country by hurting our economy and taking advantage of people who are trying to make a living. But the individual citizen is the victim, and they're the ones that need to worry about protecting themselves.
Okay, you've written a book about how to spot a terrorist. I want to really talk about this because I think people think the terrorist looks like the boogeyman.
Well, they don't. Many times they look like you and I. And so
they're good looking then.
One of us needs glasses. What I would say is that when you look at terrorism today, there are indicators of what a terrorist might be doing. Everybody talks about profiling. Profiling's wrong. Let me be very, very clear. Law enforcement, the U.S. government does not profile. We don't care what religion you are, what race you are, what country you came from. That doesn't tell us anything. What we look for are indicators, and indicators are unbiased because we're looking at your actions. Are you engaged in an action that could be a sign of terrorism? So, for example, you look at the terrorists back in San Bernardino that did a shooting at a government office at a Christmas party. They were both actively on social media, posting jihad statements about wanting to take on the United States government. They were talking about the uprising that should take place. They were espousing particular views. Now, many of those views are protected by our First Amendment. However,
freedom of speech.
It's an indicator. It doesn't mean anybody was going to be arrested for that. But it was something that the law enforcement community could take a look at and say, all right, you know what? This gives us a reason to, let's see if there's anything else. And perhaps if we run their names through the databases maintained by the government, we'd see they have affiliations with known terrorists. We might see that, look, they've been purchasing and stockloading weapons within the past 30 days. That would be enough information for probable cause to be established, to perhaps have a wire on the house so that they can listen in and see what maybe they're planning or doing. It might even just be as simple as going and talking to them, which would scare them off from carrying out any actions. But it would have given the FBI and local law enforcement a chance to intervene just based on that one indicator, and that's just one of many indicators that law enforcement uses, social media being the easiest for the public to see and report to law enforcement.
When you're on social media, if a person says they want their, like Facebook, they want it to be private and not public, does that make a difference in your ability to be able to see what they're doing?
Without the sufficient probable cause to get a warrant to be able to look at information, it can be a little more problematic. But chances are it's public because the people posting this information are looking to espouse particular views to the general populace. So we don't really run into the problem of it being private as much. And even then, if we have enough information, getting a warrant to look further and doing so unobtrusively. Remember, we're not about disrupting what you want to do. When people report information to the FBI, again, it's not like anyone's going to get arrested. It's more about, can we take a cautious look, see if there's a threat to keep the public safe? And at the end of the day, it may be nothing more than going and talking to the person, not saying how we came about the information because we want to keep the reporting anonymous and make sure people continue to provide information. If there's nothing wrong, we shake hands and walk away. But if there's something there, we could very well have stopped another major attack that cost human lives.
Very true. Very true. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a few. Okay. Thanks for staying with us. We're talking about the different indicators that somebody might be a terrorist and things that people should watch out for. Give us more tips.
Well, another example of an indicator, we've already talked about social media, supplies. People who are stockpiling things that can be used for terrorist activities. We can go back to the Oklahoma City bombing, where Terry McVeigh was buying barrels and filling them with fertilizer, enough to fill a truck, and stockpiling, and also using oils to ignite the explosives for the truck. on the face of it, what was all that for? And say, now he did live on a farm, but that's not how you would get those sort of deliveries to the farm. Him pulling up and doing it himself, that would be an indicator. And we have what we call tripwires, businesses out there where products can be purchased that can be used for terrorist activities. If somebody is making an unusual purchase, we hope that that tripwire will pick up the phone, call the FBI, call law enforcement, and report their suspicions. So, for example, beauty supply stores. There are certain products in beauty supply stores that can be used in making explosives. Now, if you're going in and buying a bottle or two, that's nothing unusual. But if you go in and say, give me every bottle you have on the shelf, which has happened, that would be a sign of a potential indicator that, hey, maybe I should pass this guy's information along. But it's not just the innocuous stuff like that. Gun stores, for example, if somebody suddenly comes in and starts buying thousands of rounds of ammunition and multiple weapons at one time, which we have seen in many of the cases when people decide they want to carry out a terrorist act, suddenly they start stockpiling. The shooter we had in Las Vegas, he wound up buying large amounts of ammunition and multiple weapons within the just last couple of months. Easily, in retrospect, to look at and say, well, he's not a collector or a gun enthusiast. He's buying things for a particular reason. But we always seem to have 20/20 hindsight. That's why it's important to think outside the box. Be aware of the indicators. And when you see something unusual, I go back to San Bernardino. I'll add that in addition to the social media posting, neighbors were aware of some of the activities these two persons were doing at their home. Late at night, they were assembling weapons in their garage, cleaning them, loading magazines, garage door open, and they had been seen doing that. That's kind of an unusual behavior that it had to do with the supplies they were gathering. That would have been a clue that somebody could have picked up the phone and called law enforcement. Now, because of what happened, hopefully people will think twice and again make that call to try to keep others safe.
The person who sold the ammunition to the shooter in Las Vegas, he's being sued or he was arrested. I don't remember the story recently. Did this person buy, do you know if this person bought all that stuff from one source or did he buy it online?
From the person in Vegas, it looks like he bought from multiple sources. But just to be clear, the person who was selling the ammunition that was subsequently charged, it didn't have to do with selling ammunition to the shooter. It had to do with this person was selling certain types of ammunition that could not be sold to the public. There are certain rounds that law enforcement and the military can buy that the public cannot. But there's a market for it for a variety of reasons. Nevertheless, it's still illegal. And those were the issues in that case. So it was a sub case that came out of the larger case from Las Vegas.
So everybody needs to be aware.
Everybody needs to be aware, and you just never know who might cross your path. Again, I'm not telling people to be paranoid. I'm just telling them to be aware. Just be aware of your surroundings, be aware. And if you think something's suspicious, well, take action and let somebody know. If it checks out and there's nothing wrong, no harm, no foul, but you may just save a life if you report something that doesn't look right.
Yeah, follow your gut intuition because typically it's right.
Usually it is. And even if you're wrong, law enforcement, we get a lot of calls every single day on stuff that is not a crime. No problem. That's what we're there to do. We're there to check everything out. So if somebody makes a tip on something or raises a suspicion and it turns out not to be legit, no problem, no hard feelings. That's what law enforcement does.
Absolutely. And we're talking about profiling. This isn't really profiling people. This is just being aware of your surroundings, being aware of people, their behavior.
Right. And again, we're not ever going to profile. We're looking at the indicators, and that's the important distinction. Profiling is looking at a person's race and religion and where they're from. We never do that. We never profile. But the indicators, so for example, another thing is impersonation. So I don't care what color your skin is, what country you're from, but if you're throwing on a FedEx delivery uniform and pretending to be a FedEx person so you can walk through a building and check out different government offices, that is a reason to be concerned. It's the action of impersonation. We've had cases like this all over the country. In one case in New Jersey, we had four individuals pretend to be pizza delivery persons. One person got a job at a pizza place so that he could get uniforms, etc. But that way the other persons could then pretend to be making deliveries of pizzas on a military base. What they were doing was scouting the base for a terrorist attack. Fortunately, somebody became wise to what they were doing, reported it to the FBI, and the FBI was able to intervene and build a case and arrest these persons before they were able to carry out the actual attack, saving God knows how many lives.
That reminds me of delivery people in Chicago. I used to work in Chicago, and they delivered lunches, but the lunches were actually bombs. So after a while, everything that came into the building had to be scanned. I had to look through it. And then I had a guy send me flowers, and they ran the flowers through this X-ray machine to make sure they weren't going to blow up. I thought that was pretty funny.
He did. The flowers probably died sooner than they should have. But
exactly what happened.
You know, and one other thing I will tell you, in addition to impersonation, surveillance is a close cousin of impersonation. And what surveillance is people that are looking and checking out areas. I go back to Tim McVeigh, one of the earlier surveillance cases we had. He traveled the country checking out different federal buildings before deciding on Oklahoma. But he would actually walk the buildings, look for what government offices were inside. He decided on Oklahoma because they had a daycare center. And that was a way of really making a statement by attacking children as well as the adults. But surveillance could be taking pictures of objects that you wouldn't normally take pictures of. So if I came to your radio station today and started snapping photographs of the antennas outside, that might be a little odd versus taking a picture of the building. It doesn't mean that the person doesn't have a legitimate reason or a curious interest. But if you see somebody doing odd things like that, it may be part of surveillance. Let law enforcement know. At the very least, we can go talk to them. We can find out who they are. And if something does happen, well, then we have a lead of who we might want to track down. But better yet, maybe we've scared them off if they have a nefarious intent.
Stop something before it happens. Absolutely. What other indicators? I know you've got a list of indicators.
Sure. You know, clothing. Unusual clothing is a great example of an indicator. When we look at some of the attacks we've had, so for example, in Belgium, when there was a bombing at the airport, we had two individuals that carried out the initial attack and then a third one as well, each of which were carrying large amount of explosives on luggage carts. When we look at the surveillance pictures after the fact, every one of the attackers was wearing just one glove on one hand, and which looked particularly unusual.
Michael Jackson fans.
Sort of, right? But when you look at the two of them traveling together in a third in a different location, but the two men together, both wearing one glove in their hands, the reason they were wearing a glove, they were holding the detonator in their hand, and they didn't want a static electricity charge to accidentally set off the bomb prematurely. But in retrospect, you'd look at that, and now if you were to see somebody, say, in an airport wearing one glove, you might say, why are they doing that? Now, it could be somebody with an injury, a burn victim, etc., but it's worthy of checking out just to make sure we're keeping people safe. In addition to the clothing, backpacks, can't go anywhere with a backpack anymore, whether it be sports stadiums, because the Boston bombers changed all that. Carrying those backpacks with the explosives inside. So now if you go to an event and you see somebody walking towards the queue where people are entering carrying a backpack, it's pretty much common knowledge today you can't go anywhere with a backpack. Even better, if you see a backpack just sitting somewhere by a crowded area, like was the case at the Olympic bombing in Atlanta, those are signs that don't just assume somebody forgot their backpack, that you want to notify law enforcement, have them come check it out, so that way we can make sure it's nothing dangerous that can hurt someone.
Yeah, you don't want to open it.
You certainly don't want to open it. You want to leave it to the professionals, and you want them to check it out. I was just recently speaking with the person who checked out the backpack in Atlanta, but an FBI agent bomb professional, and opening it carefully was able to determine right away, this is very dangerous and we need to get people out of the area. Saved hundreds and hundreds of lives.
Very cool. Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a few. Okay, we're back. And I want to talk about another indicator. You're talking about suspicious vehicles.
Yeah, there's a lot of different types of ways that vehicles can be used to carry out terrorism. Probably one of the most notable ways was in Times Square a couple years ago, where an individual had bought a vehicle via Craigslist, loaded it with explosives, and parked it in Times Square. What happened in that case, though, a very savvy hot dog vendor, don't have to be anybody special out there with any sort of specialized training, he saw this car, and anybody who's ever been to New York or another major city knows space is at a premium. This car was parked kind of awkwardly. It was jutting out from the curb, blocking a little bit of the passing lane. Obviously, whoever parked it was in a rush to get away from it. The hot dog vendor said, yeah, nobody parks a car like that in New York, especially in Times Square. He notified an officer that, hey, you know, this guy left his car parked like this, meaning there's probably something wrong. Cop moves in close, and as he's looking in the back of the car, smoke starts coming out of the car. It's one of the bombs fizzling. And they were able to move people out of Times Square, call in the bomb squad, disarm the bombs, again, saving countless lives, but all because of a hot dog vendor who just recognized, you know what, that car is suspicious.
Followed his gut.
And it could be more than the way it's parked or the way it looks. It might be, why is that car parked over in a particular location? Or what's in the back of that car and why are the windows blacked out? Something unusual, but those are the things that vehicles are used for these attacks, certainly in bombings, etc. So it's another thing to be aware of.
Let's talk a little bit about active shooter.
Okay.
I've been to several of the classes. Each agency has a little bit of a different approach. And typically it's because each situation is different. And every time there is a case, I know we're learning more and more. I know you teach active shooter classes. Let's talk about it.
Well, I try to take it from a, you're right, everybody has a different approach. So my approach is multifaceted. And as a police officer, I responded to two active shooters going on in the school systems that were in San Diego. As a FBI agent, I, like everybody else in the FBI here in Arizona, responded to the Gabby Gifford shooting, and I was on scene here for 11 days. Along with every other agent working that case and the case agents who did a magnificent job. And then finally, I was in Vegas when the Mandalay Bay shooting occurred. I was actually, I'd come into Vegas to give a presentation the next day to a law enforcement organization. It's what I do now. I spend a lot of time going out and speaking in the corporate world. But I was in my hotel room. I was actually on the phone with a friend who was at the concert with her husband. They were going to come listen to me speak. She's in law enforcement. He's in the military. And shouting over the phone because of the noise from the concert, but trying to figure out where we were going to meet in the morning. And at that moment, she says, hey, we're taking rounds. Call 911. She goes into full cop mode. I will say in advance that they both survived by doing smart things. They didn't lie down on the ground. They got up and ran and got underneath a vehicle where they stayed for about 90 minutes until they were extricated by a SWAT team, but that's what kept them safe. I call 911. They're already receiving dozens of calls. I can see what's going on outside the window of my hotel room, which was very close to the Mandalay Bay. And I got a call from Fox News within about 20 minutes. I do a lot of on-air work for Fox and others as a law enforcement consultant. They had said, hey, are you aware there's a shooting in Vegas? Can you check with your sources and see if you can find anything? I told them, I'm in Vegas. I can see what's going on. So I had the ability, because there's not a lot of reporters in Vegas and certainly no national reporters, I was thrown in the mix and I reported live for Fox, CNN, NBC, and others from the scene during the actual shooting, and then in the following 3 days, staying there with the aftermath. So I've got to go behind the scenes, see a lot that took place, And when I teach active shooter, I talk about the planning and what it actually looks like on the inside. Of course, I have a lot of descriptive photos that I'm able to show to the audience so that I can take them behind the scenes and show them the chaos that takes place, but how you can rise up from that chaos and you don't have to be like everybody else. You can take action. So Mandalay Bay is a great example. The old training for shooting was get down on the ground, stay down.
Right.
We don't teach that anymore. Obviously, I think everybody listening knows it's run, hide, fight. But when you look at Mandalay Bay, a lot of people stayed on the ground. Being close to it and having a lot of audio and video from it, I could hear people admonishing others, don't get up, stay down, waiting to be rescued. You have to take matters into your own hands. So the typical active shooting lasts about 5 minutes. The average police response in the United States is going to be about 8 minutes, which means it's going to be over before the cops even get there, more times than not. Sometimes the cops can get there very quickly because they're close by, but they can only do what they can do. You need to be able to take action. If that means running, if it means hiding, and if it means fighting, whatever it takes to keep yourself safe.
Yeah, you don't want to stay down if you're in the middle of something. You want to stay down where you're safe. Like
right.
They did, you know, under a car.
But people train and will react the way they train. And prior to that, there really hadn't been a lot of discussion about the run, hide, and fight. So people were staying down because that's what we've always been taught. That's what every television drama has, and getting down and hiding under a table or something. It's not what we should do. And we've seen historically, whether it was McDonald's back in 1984, where an active shooter came in and just systematically shot every single person who was hiding under their table because they had nowhere to get away to. That's not hiding. Hiding is getting in a location where you can secure yourself, a wall between you and the shooter. If you're in a situation where you don't feel you can run and you're not in a good place to hide, that's when you fight. And I'm not talking about taking on the shooter to win the fight. I'm talking about throwing salt shakers and plates and chairs and
whatever's
backpacks.
It in your hand, throw it.
It's taken from a guy who carried a gun for a living for 25 years. It's very hard to shoot when you're being pelted with objects. It's enough time to just distract the shooter. Now you go back into run mode where you can get away as quickly as possible.
Okay. Can you tell us that we were talking about the test run? Can you quickly tell us that, because we're running out of time?
Sure. Test runs is another indicator in terrorism. One of the most known test runs within the law enforcement community took place right here in Tucson. There were two individuals prior to 9/11 that were getting on planes and flying back and forth to the Middle East. They were from the Middle East. They were studying in programs at ASU. They had been back and forth many, many times, but on one particular flight, they wound up getting, one of them got up in the back of the plane, walked all the way forward to the cockpit, and tried to get into the cockpit. He claimed he was looking for the lavatory. The plane made an emergency landing. This was in 2000. They immediately filed a lawsuit against U.S. Airways, and U.S. Airways put out a notice, basically, we have to be more sensitive to our foreign passengers. 9/11, we've seen pictures of them celebrating because they were part of the test run to see what they could get away with on an airplane and to try to get airlines to back off from confronting people who were doing things that otherwise would look suspicious. You're never getting into a cockpit today, but back then, that was an example of a test run right from our hometown.
Wow, that's kind of scary. It's scary stuff. What I didn't understand when I heard about the how they were training, These pilots were training just to take off and fly. They didn't really care about the landing. I was like, why wouldn't that be an indicator to them?
Well, and you know, it actually was an indicator. And somebody notified one of our FBI agents in Phoenix, the famous Phoenix memo.
Yes.
But it was only 3 weeks before 9/11. And unfortunately, things didn't move fast enough to be able to put two and two together. The reality is taking off and landing are much more difficult skills. And so there could be a lot of reasons why, let me learn how to fly first and I'll deal with that later. But it did arouse suspicions. Now, somebody goes to a flight school and says, hey, I just want to know how to fly. We would get a lot of phone calls to the FBI of wanting to check this person out. It's unfortunate, but we didn't know enough about the potential indicators. I've put them all out of my book so that you can see what the 10 indicators are and hopefully use them to keep yourself safe.
Okay, tell people again how they can get in touch with you and go to your website to buy these books.
Follow me on Twitter. I put out safety tips every single day to help you keep yourself and your family safe. It's Twitter at FBI John, J-O-H-N. Same thing for my website, FBIJohn.com. And you can also go to Amazon and look for any one of the books, but they're all listed on the website as well.
Okay. You wrote your first book, The 80 Thieves. Tell us a little bit about this.
Sure. The 80 Thieves was an homage to those who served in World War II. My dad had been in the Navy for 30 years, but he was captured one day after Pearl Harbor and spent the entire war in a Japanese prison camp. I took his stories and went around the country interviewing the other surviving prisoners of war that spent 4 years with my father and wrote their stories up in a book that was published in time for one of the anniversaries of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And the 80 thieves, there were 80 of them that were singled out as prisoners of war and kept separated in a prison camp. It was to document their exploits and what took place. One of the things I love about the book, when my father was captured along with the others, they were given some time to gather clothing and food in a sea bag to take with them to a prison camp. For whatever reason, my dad thought it would be a smart idea to bring a camera with him. And he packed the camera in his sea bag. And in prison camp, he was able to take pictures of the inside of the actual prison camp. Very few such pictures exist. And he hid that film for the rest of the war and brought it home and had the pictures developed. So within the book, I show images of what the actual prison camp and prisoners looked like in the camp at the time.
Was he with John McCain?
He was not. John was in Vietnam. My dad was World War II, but both in the Navy.
No, I mean in the same like area, same prison?
No, they were different locations and different prison camps.
Okay. I was just wondering because I was seeing the picture. Is this your dad?
It is.
Okay. And he was in the Navy, and my parents were in the Marine Corps, so they were all in the same service.
Right. And everybody my dad was a prisoner with was a U.S. Marine or Navy. He was a corpsman assigned to the Marines. And so, but he and 79 other guys spent the entire 4 years together in a prison camp.
Did they stay in touch with each other afterwards?
They did. They were very close. And, you know, unfortunately, most of them have passed on. Yeah. But that's how I was able to go around and talk to so many of these guys because they were regulars in my home growing up. They were close brothers until the end for all of them.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Okay, tell people again how to get in touch with you and how to buy your books, because these are fascinating books, and everybody can learn something. WTF.
WTF, how to spot a terrorist before it's too late, the 80 thieves, information governance, it's all out there. And I also have a book that's going to be coming out in the future, Disorderly Conduct. It's the humorous stories from life in the FBI, sitting with the publisher now, so hopefully in a couple months that'll be released. But visit me on my website, FBIJohn, J-O-H-N.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at FBIJohn.
Okay. I want to thank you for coming down from Phoenix to do the show with us today. And I want to tell everybody that next week we will have bicycle safety in Tucson. So we're going to have safe bikes here. And shop local, stay safe.